Good afternoon, Wrangell. You're listening to Talk on the Rock, your local live call-in show. The time is 1:01, and we have our guest, Courtney Buoncore, in the studio today. So she is a fellow with the Society for Wilderness Stewardship, and she's wrapping up her term here in Wrangell, where she's putting together a wilderness characterization narrative. So you can call in anytime to ask a question or just say hi. That number is 874-2345. So, Courtney, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Cool. So, Courtney, how long have you been in Wrangell?
So, I came to Wrangell first for math in the summer, from the end of August to the end of September, and then I came back just 2.5 weeks ago, and I've been here since.
Okay, cool. And then, yeah, just tell me a little bit about yourself.
So I graduated last year in June of 2018 from Princeton with an undergraduate degree in anthropology and a focus on environmental studies and quantitative biology. And then after that, I figured it would be good to try and use my degree for something. And so last summer, I worked for the Forest Service as a wilderness ranger outside Washington. Mm-hmm. And after that, I got really interested in wilderness in general, the point of it, how we use it, how people use it in different areas, and sort of how I could maybe go about managing it. And so that's why I started working for the Society for Wilderness Stewardship, and I've been stationed in Alaska since June, splitting my time between Wrangell and Ketchikan, mm-hmm. working on three wilderness areas, so the Stikine LeConte, South Etelin, and Misty Fjords down in Ketchikan.
Okay, cool. Then, before we get more into this narrative, the character of our wilderness around us, I'm very curious in how a girl from New York City got into wilderness?
It's a great question. I don't know that I have a great answer besides the fact that I read a lot when I was younger. And so I came across writings by like John Muir and Aldo Leopold. And it was so completely markedly different from anything I saw around me. And I was kind of like, oh, I should really explore this. And so when I got to college, my first like real introduction to the kind of the outdoors was an internship in Mozambique. So I worked in a national park in Mozambique, kind of like doing something similar to what I'm doing now, but a little bit more scientific in nature. And so I was mapping the DNA of ungulate populations and like making maps about where they ate different types of vegetation. And the idea behind that was like, how do we figure out what animals are eating and how do we think about which animals we're reintroducing? And so that was like a really good introduction to how landscapes actually work outside of something like New York City. And so I got an idea of like a landscape assemblage. And then I decided that I really wanted to apply that to like my own backyard, but not actually in New York. So just like the country. Okay. And then I went as far west as I possibly could, like the most far remote thing from New York that I could manage. And so I ended up here.
Cool. And that was purely out of fascination, or like you wanted to put yourself in a uncomfortable situation, a foreign situation?
I think it was mostly curiosity. I mean, I spent a lot of time in my undergraduate studying abroad. I also worked in New Zealand for my thesis. And so I just really like learning about different landscapes and different cultures. I mean, my major was anthropology, so I'm really interested specifically in how human populations interact with natural systems. I think it's, you know, a kind of critical part to ecology, like how humans inform landscape, and landscapes usually hold marks of historic cultures and civilizations all the way up through the modern day. Yeah. And one of my big hobbies is backpacking. And so I figured Alaska would be kind of like the ideal locale to do like cultural assessments, wilderness work, and also I could get out on the water and go hiking a lot. And cool. So far that's been true.
Yeah. Where have you been just for recreation?
Well, it's technically for work, but it feels like recreation. So I've been up the river a bunch of times. And then I've been to Zarembo for some assessments. But I mean, everything's so much fun and I really enjoy being in the landscape that I forget sometimes that it's my job. And the same thing in Misty. I've been all around. I've done every single trail that's accessible from Ketchikan like a couple times.
Oh, wow.
And then whenever I get to go into Misty Fjords itself, that's always really fun, even if it is technically work and not recreation.
Right on. Very cool. Field work.
Yeah.
Before we get into, what you've accomplished since you've been here, Yeah, do give me a sense of, you know, you're from the city and you've explored these various different landscapes abroad. I mean, what was it like coming to Alaska? What were some of the things that immediately, you know, you noticed about this landscape in Southeast Alaska?
I mean, subsistence is huge, right? Subsistence is, I love subsistence. I think it's absolutely fascinating because it's a great example of, you know, coupled human and natural systems. And it's so integrated into like everything that we do and think about. But it's really, it's a unique and really special thing that doesn't really happen other places. And the fact that we have these wilderness areas right nearby that we can, you know, do subsistence in thanks to Anilka is like incredible. Mm-hmm. And just the connection between people and landscape is also really notable, right? Like weather, climate, everything kind of informs how people here live, which is true maybe in other places, but like more true here. And I know in Ketchikan, there's like the big joke about after like the cruise ships comes in, like in October, it's like, okay, like now town can go back to normal. And I mean, it's a spectacular landscape, right? People like actively come here from outside, from other places. And it's amazing that like we get to live here all the time and look at things. I think that's incredible. I also have never spent as much time on boats before. Mm-hmm. So that's been, I get a little seasick, it turns out. not bad, and I think I've gotten over it mostly, but that was good to know, and I didn't know before I came.
Yeah, how do you even cope with that, with your seasickness?
Like, looking at the horizon and just listening to what everybody else tells me to do, I guess. Like, because I don't know, I'm not an expert on how to handle seasickness or on boats, so I spend a lot of time my first couple weeks just talking to people and being like, hey, how do I handle this? And people, like, giving me tasks also, so I could, like, do things on the boat helped a lot.
Right on.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. So the time is 1:08. We're going to go to a quick break, and then we will be back with our guest, Courtney Buoncore, and she's going to tell us more about her characterization of Wrangell's Wilderness. So we'll be right back. Give us about 1 minute. All right, we are back. So, Courtney told us all about her coming to Alaska and her studies at Princeton and then working at the Forest Service. Not the Forest Service, the Forest Ranger. You were a Forest Ranger.
That was last summer, yeah.
Yeah, being a Forest Ranger. And now she is a part of she is a fellow for the Society for Wilderness Stewardship. You've been in Southeast Alaska, in Ketchikan and Wrangell since June, doing this wilderness characterization narrative. Please unpack, what is that?
Right. So wilderness narratives are a part of something larger called WSP, which is Wilderness Stewardship Performance. And the idea is that there are a whole bunch of wilderness areas throughout the United States. And we needed a way to kind of assess all of those wilderness areas. And so DC put forth this thing called WSP, Wilderness Stewardship Performance. And it's just sort of there's a bunch of different components within WSP designed to assess scientific integrity, opportunities for recreation, cultural value, things like that. Mm-hmm. And the wilderness narrative is part of that WSP thing. And a wilderness narrative is a written document. It's like a living document. So there's always time to include changes and edits and things like that. And the idea is to write up this report that engages with the five different areas of wilderness as put forth in the Wilderness Act of 1964, which are the untrammeled quality, which essentially means things that people have done in the wilderness, like somebody tags bears and tracks bears. That's a trammeling action, right? It's something people have come in and done to the wilderness area. So that's one of the qualities. And then there's the undeveloped quality, which covers like structures. In wilderness, there's opportunities for solitude and primitive or unconfined recreation, which is, you know, just how people get to enjoy the wilderness and how we can manage that to make sure those options are still available. There's the natural quality, which is things like water, air, wildlife, stone, stuff like that. And then there's the other section, which frequently involves history and culture. And so this narrative is supposed to engage with all five of those things, the point of which to give appropriate recognition to all of the qualities that comprise wilderness that maybe we can't quantify by data, but remain integral to character nonetheless.
So this is qualitative research, you would say?
I would say it's...
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, it's qualitative. There are some quantifiable elements to it, but the quantification comes a little bit later in regards of WSP.
Okay.
It's a little complicated.
Yeah, okay, yeah. And so WSP, this is something that, you know, Congress has passed down.
Yes, this is a federal mandate.
Yeah, okay. So it turns out that we have a call. Let's tune in.
Currently living in California, but I've spent some time in Southeast Alaska.
Hello?
I was just wondering, hello?
Hello, you're on air now.
Oh, perfect. Hi, this is Joe. I had a question for Courtney. I was wondering what her thoughts were on how climate change was going to impact recreation in Southeast Alaska in the foreseeable future.
I think that's a very good question, Joe. I think we don't fully understand the long-term ramifications of climate change, obviously. There are a lot of models about it. I think it's very obvious that climate change will have an impact, right? Glacier recession is going to occur. It's already occurred. You can see it in monitoring of the LeConte Glacier and the Shakes Glacier through the University of Alaska. That's pretty clear. I mean, even Twin Lakes is affected in many ways by the... It's all kind of related to how water flows, right? So alterations in climate that affect glacial change, I mean, we haven't necessarily monitored how recreation is affected by it, but it's undeniable that climate change has long-term and serious impacts on ecosystem and landscape assemblage in general. And specifically in a place like Southeast Alaska, I think we're going to see changes in vegetation as well, with things like yellow cedar stands being affected because their roots are shallow and there's not enough snowpack to thermoregulate them consistently. So you're going to see a lot of yellow cedar stands dying, glacial waters, turbid outflows, animals that rely on glaciers like Kitzlitz murrelet, which is a really rare shorebird, actually, pretty critically affected by changes in glacial recession. It's a big problem.
That's very interesting. I also had a follow-up question. I was just wondering, given you're working for the Forest Service, even though you're not directly employed by them, I was wondering if you faced any challenges given how politically charged climate change is today in our society and how that works with trying to write documents, adjusting for future climatic conditions while at the same time trying to avoid, using certain language and whatnot in documents, and if you find that the Forest Service has been supportive or it's been kind of a struggle.
It's a very astute question. I mean, in my opinion, climate change is a nonpartisan issue. It's just a scientific truth. My personal opinions on politics, I don't think are relevant to the fact of climate change and how it's impacted and will presumably continue to impact wilderness areas and landscape assemblage. And I certainly can't speak for the entire Forest Service. Of course, there are, in every government organization or organization in general, there's going to be conflict of interest and differing opinions. I think the Wrangell Ranger District has been really supportive. I think everybody here is like super on board with monitoring scientific protocols, taking into account things like climate change and like really engaging with it. And I know Tori Hauser, the recreation manager, has also like really wanted to push climate change initiatives and educations in the local schools. And so everybody on the local level has been great. I can't necessarily speak for those on levels above that, but there's definitely been some conflict in terms of the types of words that we're meant to use and how to go about talking about truth without sort of offending or influencing anybody else.
Really?
Yeah, it's been a little tricky at times. I'm still learning how to navigate all of it, I think.
Yeah, and you are a partner in this. You know, you're not, like Joe said, you're not directly employed by them, but you're a partner and you're abiding by some things.
Yes.
Okay. Joe, thank you for calling. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. Yeah, I'm Joe. I'm currently studying forestry and natural resources in California in San Luis Obispo. Been listening to the show now for about 6 months and have been a big fan. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks, Joe. That's very nice of you. Okay. Bye. See you later, Joe.
Bye. Yeah, thank you. Bye.
Mm-hmm. Do you know Joe?
Yes, I do. Joe worked in Ketchikan earlier in the summer.
Cool. That's very nice. Okay. He's a fan of you, but he's a fan of ours, too. We'll claim him, too. Cool. So that was a great question. So, yes, you were talking about the five components of this wilderness narrative. Just briefly tell me, you know, how do you go about getting this information?
It's actually been pretty difficult, but it's a lot of digging through old paper files and interviewing experts. So there's like a whole bunch of documents in the district office that I've just been like digging through, looking for specific data points, writing them down. But then a larger part of it, for me at least, has been interviewing specialists. So the wildlife biologist, the recreation manager. In Ketchikan, I worked with the Ketchikan Indian community to like talk to, you know, local people and native peoples to get an idea of like local cultural knowledge and heritage and things like that. So it's really kind of digging around and finding almost anywhere that there might be some link to the wilderness areas. It's a lot of searching and research and calling people and finding dead ends and then finding another avenue to get information.
Yeah. And before we came on air, we talked a little bit about, you know, you are coming to Alaska. I'm assuming you had never even been to Alaska before.
That's correct.
Yeah. So you're coming in as an outsider wanting to do this, this narrative, you know, collecting this data and presenting it. So, I mean, how do you kind of combat the, how do you get over the barrier of you're an outsider, but you want to make your work substantial?
I think the first part of that is keeping in mind the very fact that I'm an outsider and making sure that I'm not coming in and like pretending I'm an expert, because there's no possible way I could be an expert on these areas when I've only been here for 6 months. It takes years to develop that kind of knowledge. And so just being really upfront about that with people and being like, hey, I don't really know that much about this, but I really want to. And I want to make sure that I'm engaging with all of these things in a way that, you know, native peoples and local peoples feel comfortable and respected by. That's really, really important to me. And so I think it's a lot of like I said, admitting that I'm an outsider and also admitting that like I don't know the best thing, right? I have to direct things, but also take other people's examples and like follow their lead and like, oh, okay, that's the word you'd prefer? No problem. Things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, understood. Thank you. So, yeah, let's just get to it. What are some of the things that you found out about Wrangell that you want to share with us?
I mean, Wrangell's fascinating. The history of the town itself is really interesting, and its relevance to the Wrangell-Tlingit and the history of that. And I came across the local story about the Wrangell-Tlingit coming down the river and like coming across a glacier. And so they put two people, there were a couple different versions that I found, but they put two, like an elderly couple in a canoe and like sent them underneath the glacier. And we're kind of like, all right, like if they make it through, we're going to follow them. And then they did, and then they followed. And just like, I mean, everything about the area is fascinating, like the Russian-British treaty as well, and the sort of history of how Russia had its hands kind of in Redoubt St. Dionysus, and then the transition from that to Fort Wrangell, and then when the Americans finally took over. Same thing with like the history of steamboat travel up the state as far as Telegraph Creek in the interior. It's really interesting. And just, I mean, a big part of that history, though, which is important to keep in mind, is like, you know, there's some oppression, obviously, and that's really important to engage with in like a clear and respectful way. But I think that history is kind of, it's really interesting, and it's also in some ways wonderful to like see the modern community and how the modern community has responded to that history and like accepts it kind of thing, and like the continued legacy of Tlingit people and Native people in relation to these landscape assemblages. So I really enjoy the history. But I mean, the wilderness areas has, they both have lots of things independent of that history. There's all sorts of really fascinating natural components to it. Every species of amphibian known in Southeast Alaska is found in the Stikine Lacan, which is incredible. It's like, it's so interesting. And the same thing with South Etolin has a high degree of endemism because it's like island biogeography. So you have all these really interesting genetic groups of organisms that you don't really find other places. And are, I mean, it's a really special place.
You said endemism.
Yes. Sorry. Endemism is a term for what happens when genetic when populations are isolated genetically. So they're the same species as something outside it, but over the course of multiple generations, those populations become distinct. So they have like special characteristics that don't apply to the same species on the mainland. And that's really cool because it means that you have like these like really rare and unique creatures and population groups. But of course, the flip side of that is that they're also at a higher risk, right? Because there's not nearly as much genetic diversity to take into account and balance for things like climate change or natural disaster and things like that.
Okay. Yeah, fascinating. Yeah, keep going.
I mean, so that's super cool. And South Etolin also, something really cool about South Etolin, or interesting at least, is the introduction of elk, which occurred in 1987, which is 3 years prior to wilderness designation. So that's a really interesting little thing that we have going on there, because they're not native, right? But they were considered like a desired exotic species. And so you had 50 elk total, 33 Roosevelt elk, and 17 Rocky Mountain elk introduced. And current assessments of that population are inconclusive, but there was a group of at least 160 seen in 2010. So it's, and the population's large enough to support a hunting season permitted by the state. So that, I mean, they're still there. So that's like a whole other recreation value. I mean, just everything about the wildernesses is like, it's fascinating. There's such a wide range of geography and ecosystem. Like in the Stikine, you have the Pacific Flyway. The estuaries and the Delta mudflats are home to like 350,000 different species of migratory, or 350,000 individuals of migratory birds, and there's a lot of different species. All sorts of waterfowls and cranes, things like that. And I mean, it's a pretty incredible. And the estuary is like super nutrient rich. And then from there, you get like all the way up into alpine areas. Like Kate's Needle is the highest peak on the Tongass National Forest. Okay. Stands at 10,002 feet. And it's really cool. Like you have such a ridiculous array of geographies and microclimates, and the way all of these things work together gives you this really remarkable area. And it's accessible to people in Wrangell, right? You can just take your boat right up the river and you get to experience all these different things. And it's really cool.
Well, Wrangell thanks you for that fine characterization. I see what you're saying. It's very diverse, and yet we also have, you know, like you mentioned, the certain species on Etolin that are, you know, were genetically isolated, you know, and then there's also all the access that people have to the wilderness. So, you know, We know what Wrangell looks like. You know, maybe you can tell us a little bit more about. Well, I guess what I'm wondering, Courtney, is, you know, when you come into a wilderness area, I mean, are you like rating it? Are you rating it as far as like, oh, it's great, it's pristine, and that means A+, versus it's not pristine, it has too much access. You know, what are you gathering as far as the pros and cons, or the things that we are dealing with in Wrangell for our wilderness?
All right, that's a really good question. I think it depends on a whole bunch of different factors, right? So I am not like judging the wilderness areas as being like, oh, that one's way better than this other one. Essentially, the idea of these narratives and these different points is to have like concrete data that we can look at and be like, okay, the water quality in this area is good. And you can tell that because we've done water sampling and we know that nitrogen and phosphate contents are like below contamination levels, right? So that's like a concrete thing that you can look at and be like, okay, good. Water level and water quality, not a concern. Same thing with air quality, right? Looking at lichens specifically, because lichens are really awesome at recording pollutant concentrations. They're like community assemblages and they take them, and you can look at lichens and calculate different changes in air pollutant concentrations and things like that. So those are like specific data things that we're looking at. In terms of the difficulties that Wrangell faces for the Stikine-LeCompte and South Edelin, I mean, they're different, right? South Edelin is incredibly remote. There's no public recreation features in the area. There's no maintained trails. There's no Forest Service recreation cabins available for rent or anything like that. Most use occurs during the shoreline. There's only four relatively small alpine lakes that are large enough to even accommodate float plane landings. So your use in South Edelin is not, I guess, depending on your perspective, you might say that that's a problem, that it's not as accessible. From a, like, natural quality perspective, that's awesome.
Yeah.
There's not really a lot of degradation in South Edelin that we have to worry about. Yeah. Stikine, most of the danger to Stikine-LeCompte, I think, comes from climate change and mining issues further upriver. The Galore mine has the potential to, you know, release lots of acidic rock waste, things like that. Literally problematic. There are a decent number of structures in the wilderness area, which, again, I think it depends on your perspective, if that's problematic or not. And I think that's what I specifically like about the way the narrative is structured, is that, like, if you have a complaint about, oh, there's a lot of structures, you'd be like, okay, sure, but, like, those structures also help facilitate recreation, right? And so there's a really important balance, and that's why I think it's important to look at the wilderness as a whole. Like, a holistic value, you can't just take a single element and then decry it as being problematic if you're not taking into account how that is impacted and affected by all of those other points.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, kind of run down again, you know, the narrative is different than a study in that it is more qualitative. But is there something else I'm missing about the narrative? You know, is it, it doesn't have a certain agenda, or it is, you know, what more can you tell me?
Right. So the narrative is like the second step in this section of WSP, kind of. The first step is like, so it's called, they split it up into the point system. So a narrative is 4-point work is what it's called. 2-point work is hard, like assembling a central database of files about wilderness areas. And 4-point is the narrative. And the idea is of the narrative is to be kind of a guideline moving forward for 6- and 8-point work, choosing those specific data points like I was talking about. So because we've written this narrative, we can now see like, oh, cultural stuff is incredibly important. We need to put a lot of like workforce and manpower to making sure that we're preserving and assessing those things. And in something like Stikine-LeCompte with structures as well, you want to make sure that you're doing solitude monitoring and like recreation site inventories to make sure that people's opportunities for recreation aren't being degraded. So you can think about the narrative as kind of like an overview that highlights specific things as recommendations for what we can do to monitor moving forward.
Okay. So these recommendations, you mentioned to keep an eye on mining that is in British Columbia that's always a potential hazard. You mentioned climate change, which is just, you know, it's just huge and obvious. What other recommendations do you have?
So I think that I'm not entirely the best person to have recommendations because a lot of it depends on what the local districts are, what they're granted in terms of funding, and who they have on hand to do these monitorings. But I think, you know, the water quality assessment is big, like you said, with the mining. And also solitude monitoring, I think, is really important. So that engages with the recreation component of it, right? So I think there's also different recommendations for each of the different factors. So the natural quality would be lichen concentrations, which is already happening. Somebody's already doing that. Water quality monitoring, the glacial recession, which is being done by the university, things like that. And then for recreation, solitude monitoring, which essentially, to clarify, solitude monitoring is it's a protocol in which you kind of determine how many different recreationists are using areas at different points, and as well as how. And thinking about how you can sort of like manage the wilderness area such that people are allowed and encouraged and have access to these wilderness areas without giving so much access that there's like a buildup of debris or degradation or something like that. Yeah. But it's hard to manage that if you don't actually have numbers about it. Mm-hmm. So I would say that getting more of a handle on how that operates would be pretty important and good to do. And the same thing with like recreation site inventories, which essentially is like, okay, like how extensive is use at this locale and how can we tell, and is there trampled vegetation, are there exposed root systems, if there are exposed root systems, how are those affecting tree life and vegetation in the area.
And so what you're saying is you don't have those numbers, but you are saying based on this narrative that you've come up with, these are the types of studies that I think would be of value.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. I don't have those numbers because the district doesn't entirely always have the numbers. You know, there's some data gaps, but I mean, the people in the district office here are like really passionate about the wilderness areas and have done a lot of work with like pretty limited resources. Mm-hmm. And so I think that I wouldn't be surprised if monitoring increases moving forward and like we have a more concentrated pile of data to look at and draw from.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Courtney, we might have another call coming in, but we can wrap up pretty shortly. I'm waiting for this call, actually. Just letting everyone know, the time is 1:34. We've got Courtney Buoncore. I hope I'm saying that okay.
Yeah, you are.
It took me a while. And she is a fellow with the Society for Wilderness Stewardship. Okay, and we've got a call for you from one of my friends. Hello.
This is Maria. And I guess you just stated a little bit. I just wanted to find out the background of this company that she works for. And what is the relationship with the Forest Service?
That's a great question. The Society for Wilderness Stewardship is a partner organization with the Forest Service. So essentially, they hire a team of a cohort of fellows every year, and then those fellows are placed in different districts throughout the country. And the point of that, the reason we do that is because, you know, Forest Service employees have a whole bunch of stuff on their plates, right? They're kind of all over the place. They have a lot of work to do, and it's really hard for them to get all of that done sometimes. And so a fellow has the benefit of coming in and only having to do this one specific project, which means that they have the time to kind of interview a whole bunch of different people and really focus and allocate resources accordingly.
So they are, the Society for Wilderness Stewardship. This is a... You know, it's a contractor of the Forest Services. I mean,
It's a partner organization.
Yeah.
So it's not a contractor in the legal sense of the term. It's a partner and a cooperator.
Cooperator. Yeah. Okay. And then how is the Society for Wilderness Stewardship funded? Is that like with federal funds? Is it private?
They have a federal grant, mm-hmm. But there's also a lot of donations that go into it, mm-hmm. And fundraising that happens.
Okay, this makes sense.
Yeah.
All right. Then, Courtney, before we wrap up, I'm just curious, where are you going from here?
It's an excellent question. I'm thinking about going back to school, mm-hmm. and pursuing a PhD, but I don't 100% know yet. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of going to wait and see what happens.
Okay. And then what's your more immediate, like, next step?
I'm flying back to Ketchikan tomorrow, actually. Mm-hmm. So I'm wrapping up. I'm also designing education plans for both these districts. So I'm wrapping up some last minute things with education there.
Okay.
And then I'm flying south for the holidays.
Good.
And then we'll hopefully be back.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Right on. Be back to wrap up your wilderness or for something else.
For something else. I like Alaska.
Oh, okay, cool. Well, we like you. Thank you for coming in today. I really appreciate the conversation.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Okay. So you've been listening to Talk on the Rock, your local live call-in show. The time is 1:37, and we will be back next week, as always, with another guest. See you then.